Do you spend too much effort on handling content in your project? Stop solving boring tasks and get back to code. Let's thank our sponsor, Content.ai. They are the modular content platform that enables marketers and developers to plan, create, and deliver experiences that look and feel great on any channel, not just websites. But if a website is your main channel, you can leverage the CDN-backed content delivery with .NET Core SDKs, .NET Model Generator, and a Fluent API, which makes it easier to filter and order content. What makes Content.ai truly unique is the ease of doing business with them. Hubs in New York, London, Amsterdam, Brno, and Sydney, Content.ai's globally distributed team ensures the success of leading companies like Zurich Insurance, Angolia, and Oxford University. See more at content.ai, that's content with a K, .ai/developers. That's content.ai/developers. Or visit them live at the Live 360 conference in Orlando or Dev Intersections in Las Vegas. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm chatting with John Silvera. He's the managing director of Fuse Technologies and the Fuse Center, which is a local center of excellence for digital learning, as well as the thing that I'm most excited about, which is Fuse on Nintendo Switch. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I discovered Fuse 4 on the Nintendo Switch, which I have called, and this is my term, not yours, Visual Studio for the Nintendo Switch, which I just thought is the most amazing idea that I'm actually coding Switch games because I didn't even know how to get started. But it seems like you have a bigger plan than just having a popular Switch application.
I think our main goal is actually quite simple and succinct in what we're trying to achieve, which is just making learning to code as easy and as accessible as possible. There is a bit of a trick to that we use, for want of a better cliche, the gamification of coding. So we often, you know, we use games programming mechanics to teach coding. There is a danger with that because we are very much education facing. When we're dealing with schools, actually, we have to be careful about saying, oh, it's about learning to code video games, because shockingly, games are still frowned upon. You know, playing games can be seen as a waste of time. And so we kind of play it down a little bit, apart from obviously what we do with Nintendo Switch, which is just full on. You're learning to code games on a gaming console.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it really depends on the audience, right? So if I were a teacher or a school administrator, or if the folks listening to the show are those people, you'll be like, we have a platform and a community to learn about coding and projects. And then, but if we were talking to Switch enthusiasts, we would like, hey, buckle up. You can make games on your Switch for your Switch. And it's a totally different pitch.
Exactly. And it's funny. I mean, part of our computing curriculum in the UK is when you go into secondary school. So that's about age 12, 13. So just before you're starting to pick your subjects that you're going to be going for your GCSEs and qualifications in, they generally start looking at things like Python. And one of the topics will be something along the lines of learning to sort data tables in Python. To a lot of kids around that age, that's not particularly exciting. So when we go in, actually what we do is we might write a quiz game or a little Pokemon style trading game where you're using structures and data and you're sorting through that data and doing all kinds of things. And at the end of the project, you've learned to sort data tables. But actually the difference is you've really learned to sort data tables because it's been exciting and fun and so on. So that's kind of our approach across the board, but it takes a little while to convince the schools that, you know, this is a great way forward. And so it's, yeah, slowly, but we do then have our other sort of aside, which is the games development platform for the Nintendo Switch. But actually that was originally developed on Windows. And we had our own computer that we built based on a Raspberry Pi. We had a special version of BASIC, again, Fuse BASIC made for that purpose. Yeah, that became technically a real problem for us to carry around 30 computers and monitors and screens and all this stuff to schools. And actually, the original idea behind Fuse came from back in 2012 when my children were playing on various different consoles, and I got an old computer out of the attic and set it up, an old BBC Micro, and they were fascinated by it. I'm really engaged. It was really odd. I was really taken back by that. The level of interest in a text-based game. We used to have Granny's Tea Shop or something. And then my son, who at the time was about 14 or 15, wanted to learn how to write a text adventure. And, you know, again, really, really keen. So being a bit of the sort of entrepreneurial type, I saw that as surely there's something in this. If we could recreate a computer that was similar to what we had back in the 1980s and late 70s, that made coding that accessible, maybe that would be something we could make a business out of. And that's actually where it started. And so we had our own hardware. And that went on for quite a few years. But unfortunately, the Raspberry Pi would change its specifications, even the layouts of holes and screw sizes and all kinds of things, let alone, you know, more complex spec. But every time it happened, it meant all our stock was in trouble. And in the end, it became too much, and we decided that we would just focus on doing our workshops in schools. But then in 2017, decided to go to Nintendo, because that was just after the Switch was announced and it was just about coming out. And you could see that that device, or at least I believed that device, was the nearest thing to a Commodore 64 or a ZX Spectrum that we had in the olden days. It was mine. It's my computer, and, you know, you've got it in your hand. It's completely, you're isolated with it. And actually, it brings back all the phrases, you know, bedroom coding and all this sort of stuff. But now you can take it on a train or in the back of the car. And could we make that accessible in the same way? And we that's what we went to Nintendo with. It was that idea, that sort of a demonstration of it, of that. And they loved it. Absolutely loved it. The UK division were really enthusiastic, and so they pushed it to Germany, and then the German side, where the technical guys are, the senior technical guys there, they loved it. And then it was all, they translated all the proposal to Japanese, and it went to Japan, and they loved it. And so we were then signed up as an official Nintendo developer. Then that question that you mentioned earlier about, did we code it in-house? There's a very interesting story to that that I would be very happy to share if you would like to hear that.
Yeah, I'd like to understand about how it got developed, but I want to pause a little bit and just parse some of the things that you said, because there's a lot worth exploring here. So first, when the Switch came out, we all saw the original videos with the click as the two controllers pop on the side, and I think we all thought it was great. I don't think anyone, even Nintendo, thought it would be as big as it turned out to be. I mean, it is a wildly successful console, as big as anything that happened with like PlayStation and early consoles. So you must have known you were taking a chance on a complete, like, other than on Nintendo, a totally trusted company, a completely new console. You could have tried to get this on Xbox. You could have tried to get this on PlayStation, but you went with this little handheld, brand new handheld.
It's tricky. I'm a fan of games, and I like games. Nintendo has always been very close to my heart in terms of the games themselves. I do think that Nintendo is the most unique game inventor that we've seen. But it's also the target audience of those games. You know, they do appeal to young people. I mean, I know that all games appeal to young people. Violent, horrible games appeal to young people. That doesn't make them great games for young kids. Nintendo's games are made for children. And so it works across all the levels. Parents will invest in Nintendo because they know it's a safe platform for their kids. Kids love silly games, you know, the beautifully visual games. So I think that's part of the reason, is it's just more suited to the younger audience, which is where we want to focus. You know, we know, as I think probably your entire audience knows, that very young people can learn to code. 8 years old is not, you know, we teach occasionally as young as 5 years old. Now that's a little bit rare, but we do. But certainly 6 and 7, teaching them text-based coding, it's fine. And then when we get to 8 and 9, well, actually, by that point, we're teaching pretty advanced stuff. You know, we're onto arrays and structures and all kinds of stuff by age 8 and 9. Even vectors in 3D world space. It's ludicrous, but they, of course they're going to pick it up because they're just sponges, open and enjoying and loving the gaming side. Yeah, that was the Nintendo sort of focus was, it is a gaming platform, it's aimed at young people, it's more accessible than the other consoles. And I think there's a lot to be said for that solo experience, you know, the it's yours, it's just you and the handheld device. It, I don't know, I think you just get closer to it, more absorbed and so on. Yeah, I mean, we were really taken by it.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of shows lately on my kind of love affair with the Commodore 64, which was really popular in the U.S. You know, everyone had that 6502-based machine that was theirs. And there's no internet. There's you and a book alone. You're in airplane mode because it's the 80s.
Totally.
And, you know, the same thing applies. This is a single-tasking machine. You're not on the internet. You're doing your thing, and you're alone with your computer. I think it's also worth pointing out that Nintendo was very prescient in their early use of USB-C, and they are unlocking pieces of the Nintendo Switch hardware, which hasn't changed other than the OLED improvement. We've recently seen Bluetooth audio just got lit up, so we all got an upgrade. I think it would be hard to code on a Nintendo Switch using the touchscreen, but you support external keyboards, which I found to be extraordinary.
Yes, I struggle a little bit, but I don't not struggle with. I literally only ever code on the Nintendo Switch using the touchscreen keyboard.
Wow.
And I know I'm not the only one. Obviously, when we teach, we actually do teach with keyboards. We have a separate keyboard because it's just obvious it works far better. But actually, so I'm very comfortable coding with two fingers, with the keyboard and with the touchscreen keyboard, and I code programs maybe 2,000-3,000 lines. It's very comfortable. But the keyboard, yeah, it was just an obvious accessory that it you know, to have that. And also the fact that you can use that then with the dock. You put the Switch into the dock, you've got a full screen, and you've got your keyboard in front, and hello, I'm back to my Commodore 64 again.
That's brilliant. The dock, and having, of course, USB-A on the dock, gives you that bridge. And then any old keyboard that you have around available works just fine. Surely, though, with these kind of walled gardens, whether they be, you know, the Xbox App Store, the PlayStation App Store, or the Nintendo App Store, there's always some unknown, faceless person who could at any point just go, no, we can't have you have access to the keyboard, and you're not allowed in the store. Did you have any concerns that they wouldn't like this?
Well, it was certainly part of our initial presentation. So when we went to them, you know, it was all about having a keyboard there in front of the device. So right from the outset, this is what we were presenting, and it was never questioned. I don't think the keyboard ever looked to be a problem. There were problems with other things. For example, audio, actually microphones and audio, that we could do some clever things using audio out and audio in that would give us ways of saving and loading applications a bit like an old cassette deck would. And actually, you know, that was taken to a certain point and then decided, no, it wouldn't be the best thing to do. And I think, you know, there are areas of that I completely agree with, that it could be someone could damage their device by plugging something in, you know, that they weren't supposed to. But it could be achieved anyway. But yeah, it was a shame. And I'd still like to explore. We have got a few users that have written or created using little mini Arduinos. They've created USB keyboard emulators. And so you can have an external influence generating key presses that Fuse picks up. So I've got some kids local to us here that have written a Scalextrics. You know, Scalextrics, the car racing. Yeah. They have a timer, a lap timer. So every time the car goes around, they have a sensor in, they've embedded a sensor into their Scalextrics kit. When the car goes past it, it registers, presses a key, and that's picked up, and you get a timer on screen. And it, you know, these, so some people are very creative with what they will do. But no, there are a few restrictions, but actually a lot of the fact that it's a closed system also helps in some ways. At least you know where you are, and you can work within that framework.
Some stores have a problem with stores within stores. I've seen different retro stores who struggle with that. Do they consider you a store within a store? Because you can download content, but it's not for money.
Well, that's the point. There's no financial transaction from within the application. And that would raise the complexity at the whole platform massively. There's a phenomenal amount of game asset content out there. And you also have to an extent, you have to moderate it. There's some very dangerous things that could then suddenly start appearing on YouTube, you know, if it was open in that way. So that is restricted. Wanted to do, but we've not got to the point where we've realized it, is to have additional content that would be sold as DLC packs on the eShop. And so that's something that we would pursue if it becomes right at the time. We have some that could be done with, but
those kind of things would be great. Like, I'd love to download, like, even Nintendo licensed, you know, Little Mario People or whatever, like whatever you can come up with. I think that'd be fun.
Absolutely. I think Nintendo were working on Game Builder Garage and things like that as well for a long time, so that I don't think we would have got that through. But you know, I would love Capcom or any of the big brands, as Konami and so on, to have just a series of arcade graphics that you could put
in. Yeah, give me some wallpapers, some Street Fighter wallpapers, and I'll go and build on top of those. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, this is a time during COVID where a lot of engineers are very overwhelmed. I think we're all overwhelmed. And the ability to talk to someone is absolutely essential. Folks like BetterHelp are trying to make therapy more accessible. Life doesn't come with a user's manual, and when it's not working for you, it's very normal to feel stuck. Being able to find someone to talk to, especially if you're struggling with imposter syndrome, like a lot of us engineers do, can be really, really important. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Hansel Minutes. That's betterhelp.com/Hansel Minutes. One of the things that I think is fun, if you go over to fuse.co.uk and you click on Nintendo Switch, is you go down and look at the reviews. And the reviewers, they didn't know what to do with this. And I get one of the best reviews that I saw was, you know, they're all 9 out of 10, 5 out of 5. But one particular review stood out that said, Fuse is a labor of love, and you will get out whatever you're willing to put in. And they appeared, in my opinion, a lot of these reviewers to be overwhelmed by, what have I done? I see a keyboard. I see a bunch of text code. I see a huge amount of content, a huge community. But I wasn't clear that the reviewers were willing to go and spend a couple of months learning.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the first wave of reviews were surprising. I mean, you know, it's difficult. I've been in the software publishing game for a long time, and I've published other gaming programs in the past, but many other products. Over 200 products that I would have been involved in publishing, not games necessarily. You know that you're going to get bad reviews. It doesn't matter what's, you know, you're always going to get bad reviews. We didn't get one. We never had one. And I think part of that is, yes, people don't necessarily, some people wouldn't know really what to do with it. What is it? How are you going to find out it's bad? I don't even know what it does, but it looks brilliant and the idea is brilliant. And so, you know, it all rested on that. But then very shortly afterwards, a number of reviewers and tubers and so on actually started producing content for it and teaching with it and all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, you've got something right. That at that point, it was really, we could see that it's a good language, and that's all you care about. Is it actually, does it do what it's set out to do, which is make learning easy and make it fun? Mm-hmm. A critical component, and actually this goes back some years, because this isn't the first product like this we've published. There was a program around 2000 called Div Games Studio, and it was actually developed by a Spanish chap for his thesis at uni or something. And it was actually written on a 386, but we saw it, and actually it was Fuse for Nintendo Switch, but back in 2000 on a low-end PC. Very similar in its environment. It had an editor built in, it had graphics editing built in, sound editing, and all kinds of different tools that are there on your desktop all at once. So it was called Div Game Studio. It was a game studio. Funnily enough, Fuse was going to be called Fuse Code Studio. And we were threatened by a company that didn't like us using that name, which was a real shame because it is a coding studio at the end of the day. But that was the point about having everything there accessible under one roof, so you didn't have to look far afield. And that, again, though, is also very valuable in the Nintendo on the Switch because of that closed platform. You can't go and get a graphics editor and use it, whereas obviously with Windows or anything else you can. So it's a hidden benefit, but it's very obvious, really. The more you put in there that allow people to create, the more assets you put in. We had to put a lot of gaming assets in. You know, on Windows, you could get away with putting hardly anything because it's what you're one click away from a Space Invader or from a Pac-Man or from a Mario or whatever it might be. On the Switch, you cannot access anything. So we've got hundreds of thousands of assets in there to help, and so you can make your own. But it was received very well.
Yeah, and it really is an IDE. It's an integrated development environment. It is a coding studio. For folks who, of course, are listening to this on a podcast, they can't see it. I lovingly call it, again, Visual Studio for the Switch, because you open it up and you go, wow, this looks familiar. I know this. And this is not a toy. It's fun. It's for kids. But you've got 3D. You've got powerful 3D engine. You've got ambient lighting. So you can go and make a little, you could make Pitfall and have a little person run across the, or you could do a full 3D game. And if I understand correctly, there's the Fuse application, Fuse 4 that you buy, but there's also a free Fuse player.
Not free. Well, again, it's all comes, there is an ethos here that is about getting people interested. And actually, again, okay, so games are a great way of doing that, but also creating an environment where you're encouraged to succeed and you're encouraged to show off. So first of all, the community that we have, the Fuse Arena community, is very, very supportive. You know, we go to a lot of effort to make sure it stays at a safe, friendly level. We don't talk about politics or anything. It's just not allowed in there. This is just about learning to code. And so, you know, a 13-year-old can go in there and ask some questions and anyone can answer, but they won't just answer. They'll be supportive in their response. But so then the next step was, well, let's make the Fuse showcase. So let's have a place that people who create not necessarily fantastic projects, but actually projects that, there's a set of twins that stand out. I think there were 8 or 9 when they started, and they wrote some really nice little games. They're not going to set the world alight, of course, but this is an achievement by a couple of kids.
Yeah, they deserve a showcase.
They deserve to be showcased. So actually, that's what the showcase gallery is. So sometimes you might look at some of the games and think, whoa, that's a bit poor. No, it's not. That's the result of a 10-year-old person spending months trying to do this. So the showcase gallery, then that fit into the Fuse platform, so you can go to the showcase. But then we thought, well, actually, you know what? Some of these games are really good and they really are worth seeing. And maybe, we weren't looking to make money out of that. The whole point was then that we would create this player, the Fuse player, so you can get that on the eShop and access a rotating number of games or projects that have been written by the community. Unfortunately, because it had no element of pay to play, if that's right, then it couldn't be given away for free.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So that's why it's $1.
Exactly. It's $1 because it's the lowest possible price that we're allowed. In the UK, it's 89 pence. In the States, it's $1. But it's done very well. It's generated some money, which is, you know, always very useful for companies like us who don't make lots of money. So the player, then you spend your dollar, and you see these games, you've got them for free. There's about 20 that come with it. And then there's, like I say, it's just constantly rotating and you can save them. So you can have up to 50 or 60 games very quickly. But the games are written by members of the community. And this is huge. You know, when I was, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I don't know your age, Scott, what period of time you were.
I think we are contemporaries, sir.
Okay. So there was a time when, you know, lots of the computer home computers had associated magazines, and those magazines would have these listings in, and you would type in those listings and we'd all learn to code.
I would pay the children on the street in candy so that they would come and read it to me. And at the end of the compute magazine, there was a checksum. So you'd go A0, FD, da, 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 and I'd give them a Skittle. And then we would sit there all weekend long and we would write our programs.
Yeah. Well, I got a game of mine published in one of those magazines. And it was
terrible. Find them, by the way. Your magazine is probably on archive.org.
It is. It's there. It was actually, I don't really want to say it because it is so poor. It was actually ZX Computing. And there's a game called Platform Jack from Minehead's Jumping John Silvera. It's awful. But I remember to this day. And, that has stayed with me for this day. I published at 15 or 16 years old. That was, and that's the thing. Kids are writing these games now that have been played on Nintendo Switches in 50 different countries.
Oh, yeah. If I were 15, I would put that on my LinkedIn immediately.
Exactly. It's a huge achievement. But the difference that that moment makes in a young person's life, forget the coding. Forget that. That's just completely irrelevant. This is, I've achieved the confidence, the difference that makes to a young person that I can do something. That's a life changer. And that's the bit you can't buy. And that's the bit that is the most rewarding. And that's the bit we strive to create those situations as much as possible. That is the measure of success of what we do. How many of those do we get? Because then it doesn't matter. Who cares? We can all die tomorrow. It doesn't matter that everything else. That's a really important part.
That's lovely. And you can see read-only code. So if you get the $1 player, you can see the code and you can read it, because reading code is a great way to start writing code.
Yeah, totally. You can see the assets and all kinds of stuff as well. So obviously, it's a marketing tool as well.
Of course. Well, then I'm going to upgrade to the non-read-only version. But let me ask you this, though. So I can get the $1 Fuse player. I can get the actual Fuse 4 Complete Studio. But this is new and this just happened. There's a full actual game powered by Fuse called Super Funky Bowling that you can buy, that is like you took like the Fuse runtime, you turned around and published it on behalf of a young person?
Yeah. So a year and a half ago or so, maybe it's probably 2 years ago now, we ran a retro coding competition. And this was actually an achievement in itself, and I'm very proud of it because of some particular name drops that I'm about to throw your way. We partnered with a UK magazine called Wireframe, who are a developer-focused, but sort of quite indie sort of developer-focused magazine. And we partnered with a couple of guys called the Oliver Twins, who will not be so well-known stateside, although that they are known. They, in the 80s, they became the World Guinness record holder for the most published games on the 8-bit platforms. And they created something called Dizzy, a character, Dizzy, that was really prolific through those times. So they're great veterans of the industry. And then we have a guy in the UK called Jeff Minter, who is, he's one of our national treasures. He wrote Tempest on the Jaguar. Mm-hmm. So, and Tempest on everything else, and lots of other things, and a lot of Commodore 64 stuff, the Attack of the Mutant Camels and all this sort of stuff back in those days. So again, another industry veteran. And I'm sorry to say this now to those guys, but there was another one who for me personally was very special, which is Eugene Jarvis, who created Defender for Williams, the arcade game Defender, which is my passion. I adore that game and a few others of his. And we got them all to be judges for this competition, which was such an outrageous, just phenomenal. But it just shows the interest in all of this as well. And so we ran this competition and we had 30 very strong entries that really were good efforts. But one of them particularly stood out more than the rest because it was so complete as a game, which was funky, super funky bowling. And when I say complete, you've got a proper intro with animated efforts going on, and everything is considered very, very polished, but also technically obscene, because we don't have a physics engine in Fuse. And this guy wrote a physics engine. This is one young, he's 18.
Yeah.
When he's doing this.
He's 20 now, Nathaniel Stroob. He's out of Texas, and he's actively studying right now.
Yeah. So that achievement alone was what really won him. He joint won the competition. And so following that, obviously this is all through COVID and all these sort of things. So everything went into slow motion and things didn't happen so quickly, but we came back to it about 6 months ago and said to him, look, we think it's worth presenting. What if we just present it through our Nintendo relationship? Because obviously we have a company relationship with them. We have all the contracts in place. You know, it's very straightforward. We know how to submit. We know how to go through lock check and all of this. Why don't we just do it and see what happens? So we did it, and he improved it. He made some extras, doubled the number of levels and all kinds of things.
64 levels in a game.
64 levels. Yeah. And it went through, and as it's going through the initial stages of Nintendo Lot Check, all the time I'm just thinking, well, they're going to say no for some reason. They're going to say no. And and then it got to the point where they're asking questions about, oh, we haven't got the right marketing messages in somewhere. We haven't used, we've used a URL where we shouldn't do. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, this is going through. Mm-hmm. They've got to that point. This is happening. And then, we get Lot Check approved. And you think, well, there you go. This is something really special because, and not only that, but Nathaniel didn't even buy the product. Okay. Because to run that competition, to generate more interest, we gave away quite a few copies of Fuse just to guarantee you're going to get, the entries. So he actually got a free copy of Fuse. And wrote this game, and then it's published on the Nintendo eShop. And that, I do think, is just an astonishing achievement for that individual, and certainly a life change, or just life, affirming event for him that will last forever.
Yeah.
And for us, it's a bedrock.
You can do it again. You can do this all day.
Absolutely. And if we had Fuse at this point on the Xbox and so on, we would just replicate that across. And, one day, hopefully.
That's just brilliant. So if folks go to the Nintendo eShop and you search for Fuse, F-U-Z-E or Z-E, you'll find both Fuse 4 for the Nintendo Switch. You'll find Fuse Player. You'll find Super Funky Bowling. And let me tell you, it's fantastic. There's a sale. You may or may not find a 50% off sale. So
there is one now.
Now, it depends. It could be $20, it could be $10. But let me tell you, no matter how much it is, Fuse 4 on the Nintendo Switch is a very worthwhile investment for yourself, as an elder coder, or for your kids. and if you're a teacher or administrator or someone who's involved in education, consider suggesting Fuse to their curriculum, because I find it to be quite joyous. And I just think what y'all are doing over there is wonderful. So thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you for your support. It's been fantastic.
I appreciate it. We've been chatting with John Silvera from Fuse. Check out Fuse 4 and the Fuse Player on the Nintendo eShop. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. And we'll see you again next week.